The International Criminal Court hears a landmark case. Nearly 20 years after the violent Darfur campaign, the first suspect in the conflict is on trial at The Hague.
Do you wish to plead guilty to any or all of the plots?
Not a single one. I rejected all of these charges. I am innocent of all of these charges.
But what about the man who isn't on the stand? The one charged with orchestrating the conflict? And what does this trial mean for those who have long called for justice? Also, the impact of the global food and fuel crisis. The World Bank says it could go on for years. We'll take you inside two African countries reeling from soaring costs of living brought on in large part by the war in Ukraine. Straight Talk Africa starts now. The Darfur conflict began in Sudan in 2003 when rebels launched an insurrection to protest what they saw as the Sudanese government's disregard for the non-Arab population in the western region of the country. They demanded better infrastructure, proceeds from oil wealth, and a power-sharing government. While the Sudanese authorities under Omar al-Bashir retaliated by sending in militias to quell the rebellion. Among them were the Janjaweed, accused of terrorizing and killing civilians, resulting in a massive humanitarian crisis. At the time, the conflict received widespread media coverage, you may remember that, but it had since been forgotten by much of the world. Until now. The alleged leader of the Janjaweed is now on trial at The Hague for his role in the bloody campaign.
Sudan's alleged Janjaweed militia leader pleaded not guilty to dozens of war crimes charges over the Darfur conflict.
Do you wish to plead guilty to any or all of the counts?
Not a single one. I rejected all of these charges. I am innocent of all of these charges. I am not accused of any of these charges.
Ali Mohammed Ali Abd al-Rahman is charged with overseeing thousands of pro-government Janjaweed fighters during the peak of fighting from 2003 to 2004 and being responsible for atrocities including murder, rape, pillaging and torture. Abd al-Rahman voluntarily surrendered to the Hague-based court in June 2020. He has regularly denied the charges. His lawyers have argued in earlier stages of the proceedings he was not the Janjaweed militia leader, also known as Ali Kushaib. ICC prosecutor Karim Khan said the trial was a momentous day for those in Sudan who had been waiting for justice for nearly two decades.
It's a case where there is a multiplicity of evidence from different sources that the accused killed, he ordered, he encouraged a full range of crimes, the full range of crimes that are before your honours. He participated and he ordered. It seems his defence is, it's not me.
Darfur's conflict first erupted when mostly non-Arab rebels took up arms against Sudan's government, accusing it of marginalising the remote western territory. Sudan's then government mobilised mostly Arab militias, known as the Janjaweed, to crush the revolt, unleashing a wave of violence that Washington and some activists said amounted to genocide. Abd al-Rahman has been accused of 31 counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity and could face up to life imprisonment if convicted.
Now, human rights lawyers say this trial is a pivotal moment for the victims and survivors of the conflict. Let's take a closer look at what this trial means and what is at stake. And joining me now is my colleague Nabil Biagio. He's a journalist from VOA's South Sudan In Focus radio news team. And Nabil joins me here in studio. Hello there, Nabil. So nice to have you.
Good to be here.
So we've just seen a background story to the trial itself. But can you tell me about the man who is Ali Muhammad Ali Abd al-Rahman? What is his backstory? I mean, he goes by two names, and he has told the court that he is a victim of mistaken identity. Right. Who is this man really?
So Ali Muhammad Ali Abd al-Rahman, also known as Ali Kushaib, is a militia leader who rose through the ranks of a militia force in Darfur in the early 2000s. He is, for all intents and purposes, the same guy. Ali Kosheb is his nickname. He was also known in Darfur as the Colonel of Colonels. So he cultivated quite the reputation for himself when he was executing Khartoum's counter-insurgency program in Darfur to quell rebellion and put down the insurgency there. Ali Kosheb, I must say, this is a well-established policy in Sudan where the government, the military, outsource some of their operations to local militias who are more efficient, they're cheaper, they're more nimble to mobilize, and they know the area very well. It started in southern Sudan, but then in the early 2000s, when the war in Darfur started, Ali Kosheb proved himself very useful to the government of Sudan by cultivating that reputation and carrying out the counterinsurgency program.
And these guys live by their own rules, essentially?
Yeah, basically, yes. So, like I mentioned, they're not a military proper. So they're giving a free hand, and they are allowed to enjoy the spoils of war. That's part of their payment. They enjoy patronage with the government, and they get sort of an upper hand in the area because they're usually recruited from a group that is in dispute with the targeted communities.
You know, in terms of optics alone, it's been now 20 years in the making, this moment where victims and survivors can actually see at least a step towards some sort of justice. But I don't understand the circumstances really around the capture of Abdulrahman. So he handed himself over, but then tells the court that they've got the wrong guy.
Right.
So please explain this to me.
Absolutely. So for many years, he's now being tried for operations he allegedly carried out in 2003 and 2004. And for many years after that, he was active on and off, but most importantly, protected by the government of Omar al-Bashir, who was toppled in 2019. Bashir himself, it must be noted, is wanted by the court, along with two other high-ranking officials in his government, previous government. And for all that period, Ali Kosheb and others were protected by Bashir. It was in their shared interest that nobody should be handed over to the court. Bashir was ousted in April 2019, and Ali Kosheb understandably became vulnerable to prosecution, but also persecution. He was quite notorious in Darfur. Anything could have happened to him. So a report showed that he moved from Sudan to the Central African Republic, where he handed himself over to the authorities there. And then in collaboration with the United Nations, he was brought to The Hague around June 2020. And today, the next year, 2021, charges against him were confirmed, 31 counts of war crimes, crimes against humanity. Those include murder, pillaging, rape, destruction, mass displacement, you name it. And the charges were confirmed the next year in May 2021, and today he stands trial for those charges.
As far as
the mistaken identity, I just wanted to add people from Darfur. VOA has spoken with people in the refugee camps, survivors of the war. I have spoken with people from Darfur here in the diaspora and back home. There's no doubt, no one has a shred of doubt that this guy is Ali Kosheb, because beside directing military operations against rebels and civilians, he is accused of personally participating in those attacks and those operations. So a lot of eyewitnesses and victims, survivors, can recognize him easily.
Well, yeah, it would be interesting to see if that kind of defense flies. Look, you have the wrong guy.
Exactly.
So there's a lot of focus, of course, on him now, on trial. But what about the man who isn't there, Omar al-Bashir himself?
Well, that's the elephant in the room.
Or the elephant not in the room.
Right. Actually, there are a few elephants because... So Ali Kosheb was indicted. He had a co-defendant even when the indictment was issued in April of 2007. His co-defendant is a man named Ahmed Haroun. Reports show Ali Kosheb was receiving orders from Ahmed Haroun. He was the executioner on the ground. But Ahmed Haroun, who was a high official in the government, he was a governor, he was a minister, a lot of things, a close ally of Bashir, is accused of recruiting, funding, arming the militia forces that Ali Kosheb was leading on the ground. But yeah, to your point, the elephant that is not in the room is Bashir, of course. When the trial began, we spoke to people, including people in The Hague at the trial, people from Darfur, while they're happy that this trial has started, they say justice could never be complete without Bashir being brought to the court. Bashir, since he was toppled in 2019, was in prison in Khartoum on corruption charges. They gave him a 2-year sentence. Just a gentle slap on the wrist. But then he was standing trial for his role in the 1989 military coup, which brought him to power. And that was a more serious charge. Recently, Bashir has been, you could say, released from prison on medical grounds or humanitarian grounds. He is now at a military hospital where he is receiving treatment, but he seems to be, you know, quite free to roam around the hospital, receive guests.
The medical parole always. But tell me a little bit also about the controversy. And we all remember, being South African, I remember very clearly this idea of the pressure on then-President Jacob Zuma in South Africa to hand Bashir over. And Bashir was allowed to leave South Africa at the time. Do you think that there is a country in Africa that will hand him over ever?
I think it would have happened if there was such a country. So you mentioned the presidents of South Africa. He also traveled to Kenya, Uganda, and beyond his region in East Africa. He went north, South Africa. That was a close call. While he was attending a summit, there was a court that started, proceedings to hand him over. He had to leave prematurely to escape arrest. And to the credit of the South African authorities, the Supreme Court ruled that their failure was unconstitutional. It should not have happened. But other countries did not measure up to that. They just failed. They never admitted their failure or regretted it, which I think, Heidi, that speaks to some of the weaknesses around the court. So while the court can issue indictments, it relies on member countries to enforce its indictments and decisions.
Right, because it doesn't have a police
have such a mechanism. It can also speak to certain perceptions around the court, especially on the African continent, that this is a court that is not really neutral. It only targets African leaders. It goes after African criminals. This is a witch hunt. And actually, some of the grounds for Kosheb's appeal was the jurisdiction of the court and its ability or legitimacy to prosecute his case, because Sudan is not a signatory to their Rome Statute, which established the court.
Right, and that had kind of ripple effects on the continent. But there is one government that said that they will hand him over should the opportunity present itself.
Right.
And that is the current Sudanese government.
Right.
What's behind that,
Plate? So that needs a little bit of unpacking. So when Bashir was toppled, a civilian-led government was installed, the government of Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok. When that government was in power, there was a lot of hope that things would change. And officials are on the record promising to cooperate with the ICC to hand over Bashir and all other accused of war crimes in Darfur. Some people doubted the seriousness of those statements, but to their credit, they took some concrete actions to prove that at least they were considering it. A memorandum of understanding was signed with the ICC for cooperation on those cases, on the case of Khosheb, but also others who were indicted. ICC prosecutor, she's been succeeded with Karim Khan, but Fatou Bensouda was the prosecutor at the time. She visited Sudan, met with officials. She went all the way to Darfur. She spoke to survivors, to victims, and then she got promises with Sudanese authorities that they would facilitate the gathering of evidence and you know, and they would cooperate fully to see justice achieved for the people of Darfur. Now, that has changed. That government is no longer in power. The military took over in October 2021, as you know. And ever since, there has been a return of people who were in the previous Bashir administration to their positions of power in an alarming rate. And so as things look now, the chances are getting thinner and thinner. And under a military regime, there is a serious doubt that any justice could be achieved for the people of Darfur.
And there's a new prosecutor now, of course, as you mentioned. Does this make his job probably exceedingly difficult?
Absolutely. And part of the complication is some of the people in power today, including the head of state, the head of the Sovereign Council, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. He was a military officer slash commander on the front lines in Darfur when the war was happening and other places like southern Sudan. His deputy, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, known as Hemeti, was also involved in Darfur. He comes from the region, and there are serious accusations against him. So it's not even in the interest of the security apparatus in Sudan to cooperate with the court to hand Bashir or anyone over.
And of course, in your reporting, and you did mention this earlier too, about the victims' families and survivors, what would they like to see happen? And do you get a sense that they have hope that real justice would be served one day?
The good thing, they have been quite outspoken about how they feel, you know, about the trial, the ongoing trial, and other things, and we've been in touch with them, including people on the ground in refugee camps in Sudan and people from Darfur who are here in the diaspora. They overwhelmingly welcome the trial, and there's a lot of hope that some measure of justice, I mean, it's been so long now, the notion of justice is even, you know, not clear to define. But there's hope and there's trust in the court, in the fairness of the court. One activist told me, you know, the most important thing is giving dignity back to the victims, giving them a voice, giving them a chance to face their accuser, to testify in courts, you know, say their testimonies. But what they're also saying is that Bashir, Ahmed Haroun, Abdurrahim, Mohammed Hussein, and others who are indicted must be brought to justice for this to be a complete process. And a lot of people look at Ali Khosheb as a foot soldier compared to Bashir, of course. He was a commander, but if you consider the chain of command, he was a small actor compared to Bashir, his defense minister, and other people who were
low-hanging directed. Fruit.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So, but what are the chances, Nabil, that Omar al-Bashir will ever be brought to justice, practically, realistically speaking? What is your sense from the reporting that you've done around this?
The sense is, like I mentioned before, any military regime in Khartoum is not going to deliver justice. And actually, we saw that there was a big irony in 2007 when Bashir himself appointed Ahmed Haroun, one of the indictees, one of the court indictees, to lead investigation into human rights allegations of human rights in Darfur. And the guy was also in charge of, you know, refugee coordination, the people displaced by the war he's accused of masterminding or participating in. He was charged to liaise with the peacekeeping mission that was the African Union, the hybrid peacekeeping mission that was on the ground to protect civilians. He was also liaising with them. And that gave a sense that this government can never be serious about... That was an insult to the victims, right? And then, so for years now, people in Darfur have been saying, we need Bashir to be handed over to the ICC. That's the only way we're going to get justice. Bashir and all the other accused must be sent to the ICC because they don't have hope in getting justice at home. Yeah.
Even if just for optics' sake, is this dark episode in Sudan's history ever going to be prosecuted in Sudan? Have there ever been any plans, any discussions about giving people some sort of recourse at home, and that the ICC and what happens there isn't just their only hope of actually bringing perpetrators to book?
Exactly. So as you know, the Darfur case was referred to the ICC by the UN Security Council. Even though Sudan is not a signatory to the Rome Statute, the establishing charter of the court itself. And that is because Sudan failed to deliver justice to the victims of war. And that the court and the UN Security Council didn't feel that Sudan had the will or the, you know, ability to deliver transparent and fair justice for the perpetrators and for the victims. That's why the case was referred to the ICC. Now, like I said, there was a glimmer of hope when a civilian-led government was in place, but now that hope is almost gone. The future, as far as I can judge, as far as what people tell me, the prospects of getting justice are getting thinner and thinner and fading away, yeah, unfortunately.
The United States came out, and this is the final question, the United States yeah. came out back then and called what happened in Darfur a genocide. Where is the United States on this issue right now, and how is it affecting its dealings with Sudan?
It did affect the United States. While it's not part of the court, the ICC, it condemned the atrocities in Darfur and years after years imposed sanctions on the Bashir administration for human rights abuses in Darfur. The United States also imposed an arms embargo on Sudan because of the atrocities in Darfur. So, but that's a good question because it sits a little bit awkward that the U.S. is not part of the court.
Correct.
So it sounds a little awkward for the U.S. to call on Sudan to cooperate with the court, but they definitely call for justice, call for accountability for all the accused, including Bashir. And over the years, like in years past, they've imposed sanctions after sanctions, arms embargoes on the Bashir administration for those war crimes and crimes against humanity committed in Darfur.
Awkward, fascinating, strange, shocking. I mean, there are so many ways to describe the situation and this trial. I, for one, am particularly interested in what happens next. And we're going to call you
Absolutely.
Back in here
Absolutely.
To discuss this as we keep watching what goes on here. But thank you so much, Nabil. It was
Absolutely.
Really great talking to you. Thank you for
it's
giving
a
us
pleasure
some insights.
Being here.
Thank you. Now, there has been a lot of talk about whether Russian President Vladimir Putin could someday face trial for war crimes at the International Criminal Court. Now, war crimes are violations of international humanitarian law. Intentionally targeting civilians, using child soldiers, and committing acts of torture and rape are war crimes. No single document codifies all war crimes.
War crimes are violations of international humanitarian law. Intentionally targeting civilians, using child soldiers, and committing acts of torture and rape are war crimes. No single document codifies all war crimes. However, the core principles of international humanitarian law are enshrined in the Geneva Conventions, most of which came into effect after World War II, and the Rome Statute, which established the International Criminal Court, or ICC. Intention is a necessary component of a war crime. For example, shelling a hospital by itself is not a war crime, but doing so intentionally or recklessly would be. ICC. The ICC is charged with prosecuting individuals for war crimes and for crimes against humanity, such as genocide. While Ukraine is not one of the court's 123 members, it has granted the ICC jurisdiction. The ICC's chief prosecutor, Karim Khan, said in February that he would investigate suspected atrocities in Ukraine. Based on the court's findings, it could prosecute individual Russians for war crimes, but could not investigate the Russian state for crimes of aggression. That is because Russia, like the United States and China, has not signed on to the ICC. The ICC also cannot try people in absentia. So Russian suspects could not face trial unless they were physically present in the ICC's courtroom. Other options. Individual countries could prosecute Russian officials or military personnel for violations of international law under the legal concept of universal jurisdiction. Such cases, however, do not usually lead to enforceable punishments for the perpetrators. In addition, many national laws prohibit the prosecution of sitting heads of state, such as Russian President Vladimir Putin and senior government officials. Another option would be to establish a tribunal such as the one in Nuremberg, Germany, created after World War II to prosecute Nazi war criminals. Tribunals were also used to convict individuals of genocide and other charges following violent conflicts in the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda.
Well, we're going to take a short break here, and when we come back, we'll switch gears and look at the effects of food and fuel shortages across Africa and around the world. Are you feeling it? Well, as the war in Ukraine continues, how do we cope? How does the world recover from the economic fallout? I've got Buhuru Ndoho standing by in Nairobi. He'll give us some answers. That's coming up next.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
Welcome back. If you're living in Kenya right now, you'll know the cost of living is unbelievably high these days. The price of basic commodities has nearly doubled in the past year. Now, economists say the COVID pandemic is, of course, to blame for some of that, but so is Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which has disrupted economies worldwide. Others say the situation has been made worse by something that has caused uproar in the country recently, higher taxes. Victoria Amunga explains.
Patrick Oduor is picking items on his shopping list in this grocery store in Nairobi. Oduor says, unlike in the past, he's forced to cut back where he can to at least afford the basics.
Right now, the prices are very high compared to back then. For instance, the price of cooking oil, it used to cost less than $2 a liter, but now it is $4. That is over 100% increase.
He's among millions of Kenyans facing rocketing prices of items. A March 2022 survey by the Kenya Bureau of Statistics shows that the cost of living soared to its highest in the year. March inflation came in at 5.6%, up from 5.1% in February. Fuel prices have risen, with the cost of petrol increasing to over 134 Kenya shillings, an equivalent to $1.16, compared to about 123 Kenya shillings, an equivalent to $1.06 previous year. Motorists like Baraka Chege say they have to dig deeper into their pockets to stay on the road.
For this car, I would do about 3K and it would be full, but now I have to do about 4,500. Yes. Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy, bro.
Kenya's energy regulatory authorities say the average cost associated with shipping is the root of the escalating fuel prices in the wake of the Russia-Ukraine war. According to authorities, the average cost of imported super petrol increased by over 20% to $814 a litre in February. Diesel increased by nearly 25% to $844. Economists say that the prices are majorly as a result of new taxes.
Starting somewhere in 2017, we noticed that Parliament, through the finance bills that come from the National Treasury, started tweaking some of our taxes, especially for some of the common products that were zero-rated or that were exempted completely from any taxation. And they started, some taxes started being introduced to them. You remember the fuel one, trying to introduce the 16% VAT to fuel. It was a very good example in 2017, 2018.
Kenya's energy regulator, Director General Daniel Kipto, said in a media briefing that the state is chipping in the petroleum development levy to cushion Kenyans from otherwise high prices. Locals took to social media in February to protest against the cost of living with the hashtag lower food prices. But to date, the situation has not changed. Some told VOA that they're even cutting their budgets on meals.
We no longer have like the breakfast, lunch or 10 o'clock tea. We are forced to take late breakfast, late lunch, and that is it.
November 2021 national data shows that Kenya's economy expanded by 10.1%, but locals here say they are yet to feel the growth at personal levels. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Now, Kenya is not alone by any stretch. The World Bank says globally, economies can expect food and fuel price shocks, and it could last until at least the end of 2024. Russia is the world's largest natural gas and fertilizer exporter, and together with Ukraine, it accounts for nearly one-third of global wheat exports, 19% of corn exports, and 80% of sunflower oil exports. And countries across Africa are already feeling the ripple effects. Now, here to walk us through this painful situation is Kenyan economist Buhuru Ndoho. He joins me from the Kenyan capital of Nairobi. Buhuru, welcome to Straight Talk Africa. Great to have you with me.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, I guess it's safe to say that for Kenyans, it's not just that the cost of living has gone up, but that it's gone up by so much, correct?
A fair bit, at least 25%, at least of the food prices on average.
And walk us through the factors that really are to blame. We've heard everything from, you know, climate change. There are some domestic factors at play as well as external international events that play into this, correct?
True. What happens is that in economics, you talk about exogenous factors. In every economic model, you always say you manage your the variables you can manage, and then there's those things you can't predict. Now, for Africa, at least for Kenya in particular, what's happened is that you've got a place where the exogenous factors become the biggest part of our equation. Let me give an example. Just before COVID, we had a drought situation that lasted about 18 months, and it's only just breaking now. On top of that, then we had COVID. We stumbled because of the economics, because COVID. Now, we had 2 years down when we were shut down for 2 years. Now, on top of that, on the third level, we've then had now the war happen. So you can imagine one upon the other. It's created this scenario. It's a perfect storm for an economic challenges of a bigger magnitude than we've had for a long time.
On social media, we saw the hashtag lower food prices. Kenyans were then sharing their shopping lists online, showing how out of whack things are right now, and basically saying the government hasn't done enough to curb the price hikes of just basic everyday items. What's your take on that?
You have to spare a thought for any government that's dealing with the sort of challenges that the Kenyan government, and by far most governments in the world. Now, if you appreciate the fact that we are coming from a fairly low base in terms of just the challenges of just managing not only our population growth, but in a sense, an increasingly urbanizing society. if you have on top of that now these two other events, the pandemic and then the war, and in an economy that, remember, for the last 50 years, it is in a big move towards globalization. But in a sense, what you've seen across the world, not just Africa, is the chickens coming home to roost. In that if you globalize your supply chains, eventually when something goes wrong, it's going to be very local, whether it's an international or a global event that happens. That's exactly what's happening. So if I'll give you a quick example. For Kenya, when the price of oil, clearly the government anticipated that there's a shock coming down the road, it took the step of saying, well, we're going to create a fuel stabilization fund to sort of cushion the effect. And the idea here was that it'd be a short-term measure so that, in a sense, the spikes in the price of oil will not affect the economy just long enough until the economy begins to recover. But once that event called the war extended for a while, and you can see it's going to extend even longer, on top of the pandemic, then, of course, there are going to be challenges because you can't keep a price stabilization fund indefinitely. And the moment that happened, then, of course, then the government could not continue doing that. There will be challenges because it's meant then that the government has to then look to other ways, in a sense, to release the price control to some extent so that it can't carry that burden indefinitely. And that's true of Kenya. It's probably true of most countries in the world.
Yeah, of course, these are global knock-on effects. But, I mean, you know, of course, we can appreciate it's hard to explain to people sometimes who are very much focused on the pain that they feel at the pumps or when they look at how much money they have in their bank accounts or, you know, how much money they have in their handbags or their purses. And we've, of course, heard and seen the domestic and external factors that are to blame. But do ordinary citizens have a bit of a point here in that has the government done enough to help stem these soaring prices? And what is there that, was there anything that they could have done or even foreseen but didn't?
Well, as a senior government official in my time in looking after Kenya's debt, the truth of the matter is like a parent, every government is like a parent. And I'm sure in growing up, there are a lot of things you go to find out later that your parents intervened in, which you as a child would never have known, because of the nature of the responsibility of parity. And the government is no different. And to that extent, yes, the government has done as much as it could. Of course, it could always do more. Now, the fact, for example, that we had the fuel stabilization fund in place, the fact that we also had a situation where, by and large, the government does not interfere in the private sector as far as, you know, supply and demand. But if on top of that, then it had to deal with trying to stabilize issues or impacts from overseas that it had no control over. The average citizen has every right to feel that you could do more. And to that extent, I can't begrudge them that right. But in a country like Kenya, where you have a very strong private sector trend or community, and what's happened is the private sector looks at such challenges as opportunities. And what we're seeing now is a bit of that where, you know, a lot more people are going into the supply chain. There's a very big talk around self-reliance. I don't think it's just Kenya. The fact that, you know, the globalization mantra was good for its time, but clearly we need to have a strategic, we need to create a strategic minimum by which we say certain things we must be self-reliant. And key among this, for example, is production of wheat and fertilizer. The two things, for example, in Kenya, wheat has increased demand over time, because what's happened is as Kenya's middle class has grown, as you become more urbanized, the demand for wheat products has grown also. And so you can see the trend over time, that what means that increasingly you're going to need more of that commodity. Our reliance, therefore, on a foreign supplier clearly brought the chickens came home to roost on this particular event, because it made it very clear to us that unless we start creating our own indigenous supply systems, then this is going to repeat itself. And I think there's a very intense conversation around that self-reliance since, especially the pandemic. I think the war was probably the last the last straw.
And I want to come back to that that issue again about the reliance. But I want to ask you about Kenya, which has, you know, really been in the headlines around this issue. Is it that Kenyans are just more, have just been more vocal in terms of their reaction to it? How does Kenya fare compared to other African countries, which either are or will be beset by the, more or less the same problems?
To your point, the first point, absolutely. Kenya is extremely vocal. Kenyans have become, I think, become a champions in Africa for being vocal. If you look at KOT, as you call it, Kenyans on Twitter. If you remember last year, we had a situation in the IMF regarding our debt, where Kenyans on Twitter absolutely exploded and actually moved the dial a bit in terms of how IMF responded to the notion around our debt management. So to that extent, yes, we have a very robust and very loud and noisy media milieu in Kenya. And to that extent, it means, therefore, that any small thing that's happened, you will get a lot of criticism of the government, and criticism especially of the president. And, I mean, I've had situations where there are some things that have been said to the president, to be honest, that would not be acceptable even in the West for the sort of insults that have been thrown at him. So that's a first fact. True, we are a lot noisier, so you hear a lot more about Kenya because Kenyans are very outspoken. But your second point, just because of this global situation has created a crescendo of the idea of, you know, what are we doing to be more self-reliant, it means that it's sparked a very robust conversation internally around, okay, we can't keep playing this game. How are we going to be better? Are we going to do differently? And I suspect in the next 18 months or 2 years, you'll hear a lot more of that. Now, it doesn't help. It helps to some extent, but you also are about to go into an election. And elections just means then you're going to have even more of that brought in sharp relief in terms of what is the future. I think for the first time in our politics, the economy is the heart of the debate. And to me, it's actually almost like a mark of a maturing democracy. That is not personalities now, it's more about the economy.
Well, it sounds very similar to what we're seeing here in the United States ahead of the midterms and the economy, inflation, etc. Look, on the continent, this is clearly, as you've mentioned now more than once, this is clearly a time for African countries to take a serious look at diversifying their economies, their wheat sources. But Uhuru, I have a question around this. Why are African countries on our continent relying on countries like Russia and Ukraine for things like wheat and fertilizer? Now, I know we do have countries like Ethiopia, Kenya, and South Africa that do grow wheat, correct? So what is beyond just demand and supply and levels of production and that kind of capability, what's the disconnect here? Why are countries that used to be known as the breadbasket of Africa, why are we relying on the world outside for our food?
Yeah, I know when you mentioned the breadbasket of Africa, you're referring, of course, to Zimbabwe and the long, sad journey to take it where it is now. But the short answer to you is it's quite an economic. It's a whole question of efficient production. And for the last 50 years, Africa has been sold the idea, and as economists, and I'm completely guilty of that, having myself been trained in Australia, that you let the markets decide some of this thing. If someone else can produce something more efficient than you, then you should not spend your time doing that. The one thing that's been missing in that debate is a fact called the notion of strategic self-reliance. It's some things you cannot outsource completely, however efficient the market is. And I say for Africa, what's happened between the pandemic and this war, that particular idea has come of age, where we realized, however efficient the market is, and that's what Russia gave us, it gave us wheat at prices which, of course, are going to be very difficult for us to match. Ukraine also has a breadbasket, even of Europe, not just Kenya, not just Africa. The opening of our eyes to the fact that now we need to keep strategic reserves and we need to develop our economies and sectors of our economies where we have strategic minimums which we cannot go below. And that can only have happened where the mantra of globalization is now seen to have, you know, some issues with it, because it's clearly not sustainable long term. And so what you will see, for example, I see for Kenya, but also for all of Africa, but for a good number of African countries, that strategic reserve, that strategic focus on a strategic minimum is going to be a very key part of our economic debate. And I might add that I see a lot of Western companies, Africa is exploding with startups right now, and a good number of them, I'd actually say two-thirds of the startups are all Western funded or Western based. And it's rather the fact that there are opportunities because of this globalization paradigm shifting that Africa needs to begin to develop a lot more of those things. So to your point, yes, we're in a point where we are going to start doing a lot more of that. And I expect, for example, we don't have, for example, agriculture at scale. And so if you're going to do agriculture at scale, you must have fertilizer at scale. We don't produce much fertilizer ourselves. But to produce fertilizer, you have to reorient your oil industry. You have to reorient your mining industry. Those are the conversations that are going to be are being had both in the private sector but also in government around how we then begin to become self-reliant to a minimum level. In a sense, never go back really to a full reliance on a global supply chain. That one lesson, I think, is true of every country in the world, not just Africa, that you cannot completely rely on those global supply chains, because you have no way of controlling what happens tomorrow. You know, Russia woke up one day and decided to cut across a border, and suddenly the price of bread in my own shopping list is changed. So I have to ask myself, what happens next time if China marches into Taiwan? So immediately creates a very powerful incentive for self-reliance, as I'm sure you will see in the coming years again.
Yeah, of course, this is completely being felt everywhere, in most places, of course, in the world. But I want to just stay on that point quickly about oil supplies. What are the opportunities here for Africa to offer something to the world and to itself? How do we tackle the fuel shortage that we see right now and will continue to see for the foreseeable future?
Oh, very good question. Probably more than anything, I think this is a time for African economies to rise up. Take the best parts of economic models that we've learned, but also see the shortcomings of those models. And so for Africa to produce a lot of those, in a sense, to import substitute for the things we've been importing from away, we absolutely have to go on a manic drive to industrialize. There's a minimum scale of industrialization that's necessary. And I'll give you an example. If you're going to produce food, Kenya's population at independence, as we say at birth or at independence, was 12 million. Right now we sit on a population of 55 million, just short of 55 million. So we've basically added 10 million people per year, per decade in Kenya. And that's the rest of Africa. So our old methods of production, peasant production, clearly can no longer sustain it. But you're also at a point where we're big enough where we can invest in scale industries in agriculture. And so there's a huge move, not just in Kenya, but in a good part of Africa, to move into industrial production of food, industrial logistics and distribution systems, industrial production, manufacturing of equipment. And some of those things you don't even actually have in Africa. For example, the production of diesel engines, indigenous production of tractors. But those are conversations that only happen because you're finally at a point in a scale as a population where those things can happen. And so I have a lot of faith in our younger people. You can see, of course, the explosion with fintech space, which has, in a sense, created a lot of other opportunities. But it's a mindset change which we are seeing that will begin to give us this sort of thing. So Africa, for example, the World Bank tells us, I think 3-4 years ago, that we have Africa 60% of the world's remaining arable land. And by that they meant arable land has not been polluted by pesticides, it's virgin. And so to me, there's no reason why Africa cannot be the world. And if this crisis cannot wake us up to that, I don't know what else can. And I think a few countries that you've seen a few countries actually awake to that. Among them, of course, Rwanda is one of them. To some extent, Kenya, you see that. Ghana is another one. Nigeria, of course, has its own major challenges. But the conversation is happening around exactly your question of how can we build our own self-reliance.
Wahoro, given how volatile the world is, because I think a few months ago we were talking about recovering from the pandemic, and of course then the world was hit with a war in Eastern Europe, and that had ripple effects. But given the fact, as you mentioned, that things are different from country to country on the continent and of course across the world, what, if I were to ask you to look into the future, what would you say we should brace for next in what is happening right now?
I don't know, in Africa, I worry that this Russian conflict has potential to destabilize the entire world in ways you've not thought. I look at, listen to some of the threats that are flow back and forth. You know, Africa, for example, has a whole, your whole generation that has never seen a world war. And I feel sometimes that we are rushing headlong towards one. And the implications of that would be incredible. I think it's worse than anything that we've seen in the past. So that's a concern. But the flip side of that is quite apart from self-reliance and the need for Africa to stand on its own two feet in every sense of the word, is the fact that we've created a new normal. The world is emerging. I wouldn't even call it a world where we have China, the U.S. You're back to a bipolar world. Bipolar, I mean it politically, but maybe also psychologically, that finally we're also back in a situation where we have to look both sides before we make our choices. Mm-hmm. And so the whole question of a non-aligned country, a non-aligned continent, where a continent thinks about its own national interests first and drives that as the only doctrine that it will support, is going to be very critical. Finally, we have this thing we've talked for many times called the youth vote. The reality, the truth, the demographic truth is that the next 40, 50 years, the largest consumer market of Africa.
Right.
And if Africa doesn't take advantage of that, you have no right to stand or to sit at any table and demand rights. We have everything we need to do that. And so as I look into the future, I see us growing a consumer market that makes us the darling, for lack of a better word, of corporates everywhere. And I can see, especially in the West, they've seen that light and they're already moving fairly aggressive into Africa. What I would like to see is African countries, especially African governments, taking a far more proactive stance in terms of capacity building and enabling our youth and our upcoming leadership to, in a sense, be a lot more aggressive in taking leadership.
Wahoro, we are going to have to leave it there, but thank you so much for your insights, and thank you for ending this on a very optimistic note. I do thank you for your perspectives and your time. That is Kenyan economist Wahoro Ndoh speaking to me there from Nairobi in Kenya. Well, still ahead here on Straight Talk Africa, why some in Zimbabwe say this fuel and food crisis could also be a perfect opportunity for farmers, the private sector and the government. We'll have details on the other side of the break. You're with Straight Talk Africa. Welcome back. Zimbabweans are also reeling from the high price of bread. The cost of a loaf now has risen by 100% since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The Grain Millers Association of Zimbabwe says they're now forced to look elsewhere for wheat imports. But others say this crisis could also serve as the perfect opportunity for the southern African nation, once known as Africa's breadbasket.
Kristin Kayumba is one of many citizens feeling the pinch of rising prices in Zimbabwe. She can't afford to buy bread for her four dependents on her salary of less than $250 a month because a loaf now costs more than $2. She says she cooks a bland, thin porridge three times a day and rarely serves rice as it is now expensive too.
This price increase of bread has reduced me to nothing, my brother. I don't think I'm still the mother figure, the breadwinner for my family, because I'm failing to provide. Each and every morning they wake up crying for porridge, they wake up crying for bread.
The Grain Millers Association of Zimbabwe, which imports grain, blames the Russia-Ukraine conflict for the steep climb in prices. The two countries account for 65% of Zimbabwe's wheat imports.
And suddenly we woke up with the world without that supply levels. Now we are making efforts to see how best we can get from other countries. Australia, there's issue of floods and which affected the agriculture. We are now pushing towards getting wheat from Canada and other countries.
Musarara says a consignment of Zimbabwe's wheat has been stuck in the embattled Ukrainian city of Mariupol for weeks now. Zimbabwe Agricultural Society is a group responsible for promoting agricultural development in the country. It sees some opportunity in the current wheat shortages the country is facing.
And I think this is an opportune time for our farmers to produce more, for the government and the private sector to work together hand in hand to support farmers who want to go into wheat production. And thank God we've been having some late rainfalls, which have also helped in land preparations.
That would certainly be good news for people like Kayumba, who cannot buy bread now because it's too expensive. Many of the country's farm fields are currently full of corn. Matibiri said if the shift to wheat production succeeds, Zimbabwe can export wheat to the region and get some much-needed foreign currency. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
And that is where we will leave it for this week. Thank you to all my guests for joining me. Thanks to all our affiliates airing the show across the African continent. And I'm grateful to you, our audience, for joining me online, on radio, and on television. Thank you for always watching and always listening. From our team here in Washington, until the next time, take good care. Goodbye.